Welcome to Contemplative Revolution, a WCCM podcast. I'm Elba Rodriguez. In this episode, Alan Wallace explores the themes of enlightenment and salvation, considering two expressions of Buddhism and his own spiritual journey. This talk was part of a day of interfaith dialogue between Alan Wallace and Father Lawrence Freeman.
It's a great pleasure to join you today. This day got off for me on a very lovely note, a very blessed note. My wife and I just had the opportunity to spend about 45 minutes in private with His Holiness Dalai Lama, discussing various projects, all aimed at the nurturing of the contemplative life in the modern world and throughout the world. So if there's any sheen around me, it's not mine. It comes from my very good company this morning. And now His Holiness is off to Edinburgh, where I lived when I was a boy. My father did his doctorate in theology at the University of Edinburgh. So I feel quite at home here in the British Isles, and my family is from Scotland. So delighted to be back, but always, anywhere, at any time, I'm just so delighted to be with my very dear spiritual brother, Father Lawrence Freeman. And so it was indeed Father Lawrence that raised this topic, salvation or enlightenment, and also a number of very succinct, very poignant questions, each of which I've jotted down and had just had some thoughts. So what I'd like to do is basically sow a number of seeds of contemplation for this morning, but in eager anticipation of then Father Lawrence and I then opening this up in a real dialogue between the two of us and with you, and then listening to him this afternoon, to which I'll be a respondent, and then more discussion. So I really see this as something of a celebration of two men of faith, two men utterly devoted to our spiritual paths, and I know, without any qualms, a sense of deep mutual respect and reverence for each other's traditions, while feeling very much at home and comfortable, at ease, in our own traditions. So I've never once felt threatened by Lawrence, and I'm absolutely certain he never felt threatened by me. And we do share a deep admiration for His Holiness Dalai Lama, and so there it is. So that's the vantage point from which I'd like to begin and jump right into this first topic: are salvation and enlightenment the same? So I'm simply addressing, very briefly and perhaps in a rather rambling fashion, responses to some of these questions that Father Lawrence has raised for us for today's discussion. Are they the same? Of course, it's a matter of semantics. In the term salvation and enlightenment, these are English terms. Buddhism the first 2,400 years of its history was really an Asian phenomenon. It was studied here and there in the West in academic circles, but apart from that, Buddhism, by and large, spread very, very broadly throughout Asia, but really hardly touched Europe, North and South America, Australia, and so forth. So it's been only really over the last century or so that Buddhism itself has become a global phenomenon. And so I'm one of the many translators from various Buddhist languages, Sanskrit, Tibetan, Chinese, and so forth. And so, first of all, what do we even mean by these terms? Well, just for starters, to suggest already that it's going to be very easy to overemphasize or to crystallize or reify the differences that in terms of Christians seeking salvation or receiving salvation, whereas Buddhists are ardently seeking to achieve enlightenment. The ambience is already different, isn't it? When we speak of you receive salvation, you don't go out and grab it. You don't get it, right? You don't, and frankly, in my understanding of Christianity, you don't earn it. You don't really earn it. You're not, are you good enough? Good enough? Okay, you just made it. Now you're good enough and you tipped over onto the other side. Not the case. Not the case. And so, again, to shake up the borders a little bit, I come here speaking, of course, as a Buddhist, but this is a very ancient tradition, and even though it's traveled for the first 2,400 years only throughout Asia, it traveled to and it became assimilated into a very wide variety of cultures. If you compare Sri Lanka with India, with Mongolia, with Tibet, with Korea, with Afghanistan, these are very, very different cultures, different languages, different backgrounds. And Buddhism has, over the course of these many centuries, moved in, and then like water sifting into sand, then is taken on, is assimilated, which means simply a very simple point, and that is that there are many forms of Buddhism. And as there are, of course, many forms of Christianity as well. So in terms of this question, what I'd like to do is just set two poles, which are both, that is, two kind of ends of the spectrum. And I don't mean extremes, I just mean two ends of the spectrum of what we call Buddhist. And so, for example, in Theravada Buddhism, the type of Buddhism that is still most prevalent in Southeast Asia, Sri Lanka, Thailand, Burma, the notion of enlightenment or liberation, nirvana, is very much an individual affair. It is you are seeking your own liberation, liberation from the round of rebirth, round of suffering, round of the inner cause of the suffering, and it is aspiration to achieve nirvana, which is a realization of utter transcendence, to a realization and an immersion in a dimension of reality that is unconditioned, unborn, unceasing, divine, one really could say, because it's of the very nature of immutable bliss, and it is the very fountain of virtue itself. So it's not just some kind of a vacuity or a nihilism at all, but it's individual. And then once you've achieved nirvana, you've become an arhat, you've come to the culmination of the path, then this is your last life, and that's it. It's not that you're annihilated, but it's that you've gone into an inconceivable realm. You're really beyond. You're beyond, beyond. And Theravada Buddhists believe this is what became of the Buddha himself. He was a man, he achieved enlightenment, he taught for 45 years or so. He achieved parinirvana, the ultimate liberation, and then he's gone. Not obliterated, but he's not accessible anymore, according to Theravada belief. You don't offer prayers to the Buddha. He's not a personal god. He's not responding with blessings, responding to prayers and so forth. It's more like he just left a kind of a blessing behind. If you go to Bodh Gaya, where he achieved enlightenment, Saranat, where he first began teaching, Lumbini, where he was born, then devout Theravada Buddhists will go to such places, and they will feel that blessing. They will feel here's a truly sacred place, because the enlightened one was here, taught here, achieved enlightenment. But that's it. And so the Buddha, just before he passed into Parinirvana, he said, "Be as a light unto yourself, take no external refuge, strive diligently." So basically, I've imparted my Dharma to you. Here it is, take refuge in the Dharma. And now I've done all I can for you, almost like good luck. You know? And then he's gone. Right? So there's one. I do not speak of this as an extreme, but here is one end of the spectrum, that this is really a matter of striving diligently, applying the teachings. It's essentially ethics, leading an ethical, nonviolent, benevolent way of life. Without that, you've got nothing. You're not a Buddhist, you're not a contemplative, you don't have anything, you have no foundation whatsoever. And I think the core themes of this ethical system are utterly congruent with the core themes of Jesus' own teachings. It is nonviolent, it's benevolent, it's altruistic, above all avoiding harm. On that basis, cultivating the mind, the heart and the mind, cultivating what are called immeasurable virtues of the heart, of loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity, very core teachings of the Buddha. Cultivating insight, tapping into the very nature of the mind, the deepest dimensions of the mind, and challenging an innate sense, a reified sense of I am, that I have a body, that I am autonomous, I'm independent, I'm separate. And challenging that, the whole theme of non-self is not to suggest that we don't exist at all, which is frankly, it's rubbish, it's silly. But the notion that we do exist in this autonomous fashion, independent, that there's such a thing as an independent ego that has a body, has a mind, and stands in radical separation to other beings, that is exactly what's challenged. Not the notion that we exist at all, that there is a self, there is an Alan Wallace, there's a Lawrence Freeman, but rather challenging our reified and separated sense of self, and then replacing that with what? A sense of self is profoundly interdependent, and arising in a myriad of modes. Right now, I'm arising in the mode of a speaker representing the Buddhist tradition. On other occasions, I'm a grandfather. Homogeneously, sometimes more explicitly than others, I'm arising as a husband to my wife. I'm a son to my father, always have been, and so forth. Other times, I'm a customer, and so forth. So arising in a myriad of ways, always in a role of interdependence. And so that there is the core theme, and that is that this is liberating. liberating the mind from its underlying afflictions. So there's one approach to the Buddhist path, which really does not entail prayer to a god, to a Buddha, to anyone out there, but really seeking to apply the teachings of ethics, the cultivation of the mind in meditation or samadhi, and then finally the cultivation of wisdom. And it is the core Buddhist belief, it runs through all Buddhist schools, that it is the truth that indeed shall set us free, and the truth must be realized experientially, and there are some truths, the knowing of which liberate the person who has gained such realization. And so there's one end of the spectrum, and I refer to that with respect. That's not the school, the approach, the orientation that I personally adopt, but it's one that I respect. So it's Theravada Buddhism. I'm not a Theravada Buddhist, but I deeply respect so many of the core themes that they teach and practice. But now let's go to the opposite end of the spectrum. Especially in East Asia, in China, especially Japan, there are Pure Land schools. Pure Land schools. Well, Pure Land is another word for heaven. It really is. I mean, may as well just call it heaven. And these are focused very often on a particular manifestation or presentation of the enlightened one, the awakened one, Amitabha. As a Buddha, and literally the term Amitabha means boundless light, immeasurable light, a personification, an embodiment of enlightened consciousness, of infinite compassion and infinite wisdom, a present Buddha, not simply one who's passed away, but very much as Christians speak of the living Christ, well, the living Amitabha, someone to whom one does, and definitely does, offer prayers of supplication, seeking grace, seeking blessings. And so there are whole schools of East Asian Buddhism, which are, this is their central core theme, that awakening, liberation, and one certainly could say salvation, this is something to be realized in the hereafter. In the hereafter. And how do we achieve rebirth, or how are we granted rebirth, that is moving from this human existence to the hereafter? By the grace, the blessings of the Buddha Amitabha. It's a gift. And we receive it by faith. And so it's granted by way of blessings. One certainly could say grace. It's not at all a misnomer here. And by the grace of the Buddha Amitabha, by those blessings, then one, as one dies as a human being, one is born in Amitabha's heaven. It's called Sukhavati, which means, simply means a place of bliss. And the divine presence there is Amitabha, Buddha of boundless light. And so how, according to the classic teachings on this pure land, Sukhavati, what do you need to do? What do you need to do to have such, to find such salvation in the future life? And it's three. It's very clearly laid out. First of all, you must be leading an ethical way of life. You cannot skip that. That is, doing our best to avoid violence, to leading lives of non-violence, of non-harm, engaging in altruistic acts of benevolence, a benevolent way of life to the best of our ability. But bottom line is ethics. If you skip that one, then that's the end of the story, right? But on that basis, then something more is required. And that is in this Mahayana teachings. Now, these teachings around the Bodhisattva way of life and the teachings on Amitabha are thoroughly embedded in that framework. Then devoting oneself to the best of one's ability, to the cult, to following the Bodhisattva's way of life, and this is through the cultivation of what are called the six perfections, six glorious virtues, and they are in sequence: generosity, orienting one's whole way of life around giving, around service, around generosity, the first. The second one, we come back to ethics, but we see that ethics is couched in a spirit of altruism, of benevolence, of service. So it's ethics emerging from that. And then out of ethics, the cultivation of patience, fortitude, forbearance, inner strength, willing to meet adversity without falling into anger, hostility, resentment, and so forth, an inner calm and equilibrium. Forbearance is a good term. The fourth one is, my translation is enthusiasm. It's often translated as effort, but that's too austere. It's enthusiasm. The Sanskrit term virya, really, the meaning here is taking delight in virtue. It's not simply striving diligently, being persevering, trying hard, giving a lot of effort. but it's taking delight in virtue, right? That's the fourth one, the perfection of enthusiasm. And I like the term too, because the enthusiasm, the middle of that term, enthusiasm, thus comes from theos, God within, God within. And so there it is, where from within you're taking delight in a path of virtue. Right. So that's the fourth one. And then there's meditation. Out of that delight, out of that just sheer taking delight in devoting oneself to a meaningful and virtuous life, then out of that, as an expression of that, the devotion to meditation, to cultivation of deeper compassion, above all. And then finally, wisdom, the perfection of wisdom. And so, first of all, ethics, then devoting oneself to the cultivation of virtue, really following the teachings of the Buddha. And then finally, and most importantly, and this is where this differentiation between salvation and enlightenment gets very thin indeed, is then prayer. It's prayer. And it's asking for the calling upon the blessings, calling upon the grace of the Buddha Amitabha. Grant me your blessings that as soon as I pass away, I may join you in this pure land, this a domain of reality that is a pure expression of the mind of the Buddha Amitabha. It's not just some other place. It's not a planet. You won't find it with a satellite. But a pure expression of the mind of Amitabha, to be born there, and there, under the guidance of Amitabha, then realize full awakening. That's the idea, right? So I think the parallels with Christian notions of heaven are kind of leap out at us. But I would say, once again, this is absolutely mainstream Buddhism, right? But now when I speak of this being the end of the spectrum, I met one fellow, he's a Swiss man, when I was a monk living in Switzerland about 30 years ago, 35 years ago. And he was ardently a follower of a Pure Land school of, I think of Japan perhaps. And I was a monk, we were studying, we were meditating and so forth. And he said, well, it's all very what you were doing. I know you're monks, you're following a life of virtue. But actually, according to my school, the school that I've adopted, we don't meditate. And as a matter of principle, we don't meditate. Because if you're meditating, that at least implies that you're trying to earn your way to salvation. But that means you don't really have faith. And so in our tradition, we adamantly don't meditate because we realize that birth in Sukhavati is a free gift. It's the blessing of Buddha Amitabha. So our practice is really worship, devotion, ethical life, of course, but we don't try to achieve anything. We simply receive that which is freely given by the Buddha Amitabha. So no meditation. Right? So that's why I say these are two. And do I respect his position? Do I think he's a little bit cuckoo? I understand. I understand. He was a virtuous man, ethical man, deep faith. Good. But I'm not following that school. Right? And so many Buddhists fall in somewhere in between there, where there is a role for effort. And the role of, first of all, if one enters the Buddhist path, one begins, so traditionally speaking, and this is for many, many hundreds of years, it's not a matter of adopting a certain set of beliefs. That's not it. That's not it. Not that that's wrong, but that's simply not how the Buddhist path opens up. But it's more a matter of an expression of trust, of confidence. Very much like in a friendship. If you first meet someone, there's no reason you should trust that person on first encounter. But then as you get to know that person, a friendship forms, the friendship deepens, you see this person in a wide variety of contexts and so forth, then a deeper sense of trust, of confidence may arise. And so likewise in Buddhism, one may begin studying the teachings of the Buddha, one may start to practice, and in so doing, by growing and understanding conceptually or theoretically, by devoting oneself to practice, then it may occur, as it has in my case, over time, a deeper sense of confidence, of trust, arises to the point that one feels, now for the cultivation of meaning, for liberation, for finding genuine happiness, eudaimonia in Greek, for the most essential pursuits of my life, to whom shall I entrust myself? And if one has such trust in the Buddha, then it says, you take refuge in the Buddha. So I take refuge in Buddha. One takes refuge in the Dharma, the Buddha's teachings, the path that he prescribed, because of confidence, of faith. It's not a matter of do you believe this, this, this. It's a matter of trust, of confidence. Trust and confidence in the Sangha, and that is one's community, one could say one's church, one's fellow spiritual brothers and sisters, and especially kind of the elders of the church, those who've gained profound realization. So refuge, this deep placing of trust, an existential placing of trust in Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, that defines a Buddhist. So it's not a matter of exactly what you believe or how good you are, how and so forth, how virtuous, but a matter of trust. So for the rest, now that I've shown these two ends of the spectrum, where I'd like to speak now is simply from my own heart, from the path of Buddhism. I am a student of His Holiness Dalai Lama now for 41 years. I met him in 71. It was love at first sight. As soon as I met him, I came to him seeking counsel. I did not come to him just to meet a famous person, but with some very core spiritual questions that I had that were very important for me. He answered them with such depth and warmth and sincerity, I knew I had found my teacher. So that was in 1971. So I will speak from this point on, not as a Theravada Buddhist, who feels, you know, there's no one to pray to, there's no one out there, just strive diligently and achieve nirvana for yourself. I respect that, but that's not my path. Nor am I following this fellow that says, we are against meditation, shouldn't meditate, shows you don't really have to trust in Buddha Abhidhamma. Okay, I respect that, but I'm not following that. I'm someplace in between, where it's clear to me, for my own path, that I must strive diligently. And the reason for that is that I wasn't created perfect. Shoot. Created with flaws. I was born with flaws. And I've actually compounded them on occasion over the course of my life. 62 years of picking up like a ship setting out and picking up a bunch of barnacles. I've added to my defects, my vices over the years, but especially since I found the path to which I devoted myself, trying to clean up my act. It's breaking old habits, trying to seek to break old habits, to cultivate meaningful, virtuous habits that liberate the mind more and more from its internal afflictions, its imbalances, the distortions of the human spirit. So, and again, the mental afflictions being the source of all of the type of behavior that we are prone to, which leads to conflict, disharmony, misery for ourselves and others, violent impact upon the environment. All of these, and I think there's complete congruence here, all of the immensely sad conduct that human beings engage in on occasion with respect to each other sometimes defy the imagination, how awful we can be to each other, whether it's in a single household, one race against another race, one race against another race, and so forth, as if we don't have enough problems already with challenges from the environment, the violence of nature itself, with tsunamis, earthquakes, and so forth, as if aging, sickness, and death isn't problems enough, then somehow, in a bewildering way, we compound our miseries by treating each other and the natural environment in violent ways. It is immensely sad. And then if we look for the sources, why do we do that? Not only extreme cases like Pol Pot or the Nazis or the Stalinists and so forth, but why do we do it at all, even in the micro manifestations in the household and so forth? And in the Buddhist understanding, it comes from three sources: ignorance and delusion, not knowing the nature of reality and getting it wrong, from self-centered attachment, greed, craving, grasping, me, me, me. And then finally, when we encounter obstacles to this self-centered grasping, attachment, greed, clinging, when we encounter obstacles to that, people getting in our way, then responding with anger, and then polarization, my side, your side, good versus bad, and then retaliating with hostility, with aggression, and so forth. As Newton came up with three laws explaining all the mechanical interactions of phenomena throughout the natural world, the Buddha came up with these three principles that all of human evil, all the evil that we perpetuate, that we enact in the world, all stems from ignorance, delusion, craving, and hostility. I think it's true. And so to overcome old habits, sometimes they're very tenaciously ingrained in our characters and temperaments, takes some effort. Right? And we can apply ourselves effortfully not only to overcoming detrimental habits, tendencies, mindsets, to which we may have picked up in this lifetime or were born with them, but also the active cultivation of virtue. Four that I teach very, very commonly are the active cultivation of loving kindness, a sense of genuine caring for others. It's not a feeling, it's not an emotion in Buddhism. Loving kindness is an aspiration, a heartfelt aspiration coming out of a sincere sense of caring for the well-being of others. And loving kindness is the aspiration, may you find happiness and the causes of happiness. And immeasurable loving kindness is, I think frankly, and maybe I'm wrong, so Father Lawrence will correct me if I'm wrong, but what Buddhists call immeasurable loving kindness, I believe Christians call unconditional love. That you're not on probation. My love for you is not on trial. That is, you don't have to keep on proving it to me every day. You don't have to be good enough. And there's no way you can be too bad. And it doesn't matter who you are. That when it's immeasurable loving kindness, the barriers of love here but not there are broken down. And it's like water flowing out over an alluvial plain, and it flows evenly. Immeasurable loving kindness. May we all find happiness and causes of happiness. Immeasurable compassion. May we all be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. Immeasurable empathetic joy. Taking delight in the virtues, the joys, the happiness of others as if they were our own. And equanimity, which is not simply a calm and inner equilibrium, but an even-heartedness of caring equally for the friend, the foe, the neighbor, whoever the neighbor may be, whether in communist China or in your backyard. So those virtues, can those virtues be cultivated? Or are they simply innate? Some people are tall, some people are short. People have different physiological constitutions. Not much we can do about it. I can't become short. That's hard, right? Not sure. Yes, I can, but it comes slowly with age. Little bit, little bit, little bit. Maybe I'll lose another inch if I live long enough. The case of the shrinking Alan. But not a whole lot of malleability. If I wanted to grow taller at this point, hopeless. Hopeless, right? So there's a really, I think, one of the most wonderful questions that I'll just focus on too. Christianity and Buddhism had been raising for a long time. Are these just hardwired? Do we simply have to accept, well, I'm not a very loving person, I'm kind of compassionate, and so forth and so on, just like your DNA or your blood type? Or are these qualities that can be cultivated, nurtured like a young plant? Water it, fertilize it, make sure you get enough sunlight and so forth. And can these qualities grow? His Holiness Dalai Lama was in Spain quite a number of years ago, and he met with a Spanish Roman Catholic hermit who had spent, you probably know that, but 20 years, 30 years, long time living in solitude. And his practice was all the cultivation of love. That was his central practice, the cultivation of love, as a Christian monk. And the Holy Dalai Lama sought him out. This monk was willing to break his retreat to meet with Dalai Lama. Dalai Lama met him. He immediately sensed, here's a spiritual brother. Because he's captured the very essence of the teachings of Jesus and the very essence of the teachings of the Buddha. And on top of that, monk to monk, Dalai Lama has a very strong sense of being a monk. And he really resonates with other monks, whoever they are. He was not only another monk, but a monk who devoted his life to love. And he said, such heart feeling. I really sensed he had really been focusing. So I'm going to speculate here, but when this monk went off to solitude for his hermetic way of life, I doubt that he was just kind of, okay, I'm ready any time. Let love descend. You know, like a baby waiting for pablum. I doubt it. He certainly must have had some practice. I won't speculate beyond that point. But he went into solitude not because he was antisocial, but to focus single-pointedly without distraction on the culture of virtue, on the cultivation of virtue, and among all the virtues, the one that St. Paul tells us, there's the pinnacle. Isn't it true? So there it is. So is there a role for effort, for striving in the Christian tradition? Well, I think the answer is obvious. Go back to the Desert Fathers. Go back to the great contemplatives, the hermits on Mount Athos in the Greek tradition. Glory days, 12th, 13th, 14th century. Magnificent. The depth of insight, the dedication, the purity of their focus. Oh, it's utterly extraordinary. Utterly extraordinary. And right through the Neoplatonic tradition, up to one of my heroes, Nicholas of Cusa, extraordinary contemplative and a papal emissary, you know, great scholar, true polymath. So is there a role for both in the two traditions? Well, in Buddhism, it's quite clear. Apart from this kind of this, how do you say, this end of the spectrum, where it's total reliance on Abhidhamma and don't go anywhere else, don't do anything else because it suggests you don't have sufficient faith. I don't accept that. Although, do I, as a follower of the Dalai Lama, as a Mahayana Buddhist, one who is seeking to follow the Bodhisattva way, do I myself, just personally, do I accept the existence of this pure land, this Buddha field, this heaven of Sukhavati, the blissful place, with the presence, the divine presence of Amitabha, Buddha of boundless light? I do. And in fact, every day, I offer my own prayers of dedication of merit. Frankly, that's where I'd like to go from here. I've had enough of planet Earth for at least a while. I'd like a break, a little time out, you know, and just to be in a place that is utterly blessed sometime, you know. And then if we need to come back, okay, good. So it's part of my practice, part of my practice. At the same time, and so that's part of my belief system. Lead an ethical way of life, do my best to cultivate virtue, then offer prayers to receive grace, and then when the life is over, then good, that's where I'd like to go next. But it raises the question, all right, if one has such faith, whether it's Christian faith, that salvation is a gift. It's a gift through the life, the death, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. It's a gift. Good. And now what are you going to do today at 9 o'clock? Now what are you going to do for the next decade, 2, 3, 4, 5 decades? What are you going to do now that you've received your gift? Are you going to go and smoke cigars in Havana? What are you going to do the rest? You just kind of wait it out, you know? And there's a phrase that just kind of leapt to mind when I was reflecting upon this. I think you might have heard of it. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Rings a bell, I think. Yes, okay, good. I want to make sure I didn't mistranslate it or misquote. But thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is his in heaven. If one has this view, and it is my view, that such salvation is by the blessing, in my case, I'll speak from the Buddha. What are we here for then? Is it a waiting game? We just kind of have to wait it out? Or should we apply ourselves industriously, to making a living, to getting ahead, to building more skyscrapers and more of this and more of that, and then at the end of the day, and said, thanks a million for the gift, and then we're off? What should we do with this life? And I must say, that's what I totally embrace, that this kingdom of heaven, so I will speak as a Buddha, Sukhavati, let this be here, that this may be the blessed place. That we may be living here as if we are already in Sukhavati, already in a divine place, already devoting ourselves 100% with all our might, all our strength, to following the teachings of the awakened ones. So, as you can tell, I think there is much more that brings us together than separates us. But of course, if one focuses on the extremes, on the ends of the spectrum, I quote one Christian, I read it in a little Christian monograph or something like that, some evangelical tract. When I was a monk in Switzerland, my great aunt, who's a very devout evangelical Christian, she wanted to save my soul, I think. And so she took me to one evangelical Christian center, and there was a little poster there in the entrance saying, beware of yoga. Beware of yoga. It's dangerous. You practice yoga, it can lead to other things like meditation. There's a real danger. You start with yoga, it could lead to meditation. And meditation will take you within, and you know it's in within. That's where the devil lurks. And the devil will swallow you like a big fish swallows a little fish, and you will be sorry. So don't go in there. Don't go in there. And that means don't practice yoga. It could lead to other things, you know? So I thought that was quite charming. And if the people who are promoting that view, if they're living virtuous lives, ethical lives, benevolent lives, and they have such faith, that's good. That's good. But it's not a belief that I can share. But then what I've loved to do when I was writing one of my two dissertations at Stanford when I was doing my doctorate in religious studies, the other dissertation that wasn't accepted as a dissertation because it was just too much, too broad, was this book that was cited earlier, The Taboo of Subjectivity. So it wasn't good enough for dissertation, but Oxford University Press found it good enough to publish, and it's still in print. But as I was doing the research for that, it was really a celebration. I just loved doing it. And among other things, I began to investigate certainly a superficial level. I'm no scholar of this. Don't even read Latin. But I did do some research on the Augustinian tradition of Christian contemplation. And I'd like to just highlight this, and so I'm obviously stepping out of any domain for which I could have any remote claim of expertise, but I'm sharing it only because I found it very inspiring. So that's my justification, not any expertise at all. But this laying out of a contemplative path by one of the most formidable minds, greatest saints in the whole of the Christian tradition, St. Augustine, that he's laid out his path, it begins with purgation. Purgation, obviously, the purification of the soul. So purifying vices through confession, purification in various ways. You're all very familiar with this. So there is your foundation. And then on that basis, the next major phase of now entering into real meditative practice, he called recollection. Recollection. And this entails the withdrawing of the attention from all sensory and conceptual phenomena. So it wasn't very long ago that we did that with Father Lawrence, the meditation we did right here. Quieting the mind, bringing the mind within, calming the conceptual, obsessive, compulsive conceptual mind. A withdrawal, a coming home in recollection, collecting yourself once again as you bring your awareness within. Recollection. And then the next step beyond that is introversion. Introversion, and this I understood to be an introspective settling of the mind in its own fundamental nature. So really settling into the depths of one's own, one could say one's own soul. So it's not yet a truly contemplative realization, but it's coming into one's, kind of one could say, into one's core, withdrawing from all that is peripheral, all that is secondary, all that is merely distraction, coming really withdrawing deeply into one's core. The first step, simply withdrawing from sensory and conceptual, but now almost like going even deeper in the same route, the same trajectory. Coming into one's own core, the ground nature of one's own settling of one's own mind or soul. And with this radical simplification, not becoming simple-minded, as Father Lawrence articulated, those truths that are hidden from the clever, from the smarty pants, we'd say in America, caught up in the intellect, caught up in how clever am I, look how brilliant I am, look how articulate I am, look how erudite I am, look at all the things I know. That's fine. You can swim in that goldfish bowl as long as you like, but as long as you're there, the deeper truths will be hidden. Right? My sense is this introversion is to go beyond those steps. Beyond those steps, even beyond the depths of your own personal narrative. Oh, I'm a Stanford PhD, he's an Oxford man, you know, he's English, I am American, all of that. Going beyond that, down to a more distilled, less encumbered, less elaborated ground of our own being. And then finally, from that, one could say, I think, maybe a profound sense of humility. Because when we think, what are we proud of? Many of us are proud of something. I have a Stanford PhD. I could be proud of that. I have a really smart wife, very accomplished. I could be, oh, look at me. Look, I'm her husband. But these are all accretions, aren't they? That which we're proud of, we could lose. We could lose with senile dementia. I can lose my PhD. That's a paper that is no longer relevant to me. Acquisitions, fame, power, all that kind of stuff that we... And then physical beauty, have you ever had it? Well, it's only a matter of time. So all that we develop, this kind of, I am something special, I am something superior, I'm, you know, proud man. It's all very well. Probably has some basis in reality. But sooner or later, all that you're proud of is bound to fall away. How many people are really proud when they're dying? If they are, maybe for good reason. But my sense is when you come to this introversion, you're coming to a place of profound humility. Where you are, there are we all. Prior to this and that, this accomplishment, that accomplishment, and so forth, you come to something where there's common ground. In Christian terminology, this is where you're simply a child of God. Not a better child, not a worse child. Child of God. All common, isn't it? Same. And then from that vantage point, my sense is, it kind of occurred to me now, but my sense is, there you've come to your ground humility. Not lower than anyone else, but then not even a smidgen superior. And then contemplation. The culmination of the path, which culminates in the soul transcending itself in the experience of God. And to just elaborate a little bit, this term amor Dei, the love of God, which I have to say when I was a youth perplexed me because I didn't really know what it was about. I really learned this, got a sense of it only when I was there, a graduate student. But the love of God, which is the desire for union with Him, very interesting. That I can actually resonate with deeply. The love of God, which is the desire for union with Him, and the love of men, humanity, which is the sense of unity with all those who are capable of sharing the love of God. Those two loves are indeed bound up most intimately with one another. That's St. Augustine. Oh, I deeply resonate with that. And his embrace, St. Augustine's embrace of the Greek notion, tracing back to Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, of eudaimonia, of human flourishing, of genuine happiness. Something that's not merely stimulus-driven, but something welling up from the depths of one's own soul and the very ground of being itself. In the Augustinian tradition, this eudaimonia, genuine happiness, it refers to the perfect life insofar as perfection is attainable by humanity. The only thing we need to know, according to Augustine, I love this, the only thing we need to know is the answer to the question, how can man be happy? And I'll make it gender neutral. How can we be happy? How can humans be happy? That's the only thing we need to know. I think he's right. I think he's exactly right. And then what is the highest happiness? Because clearly there are multiple dimensions of eudaimonia. It's not just one thing like that you might achieve one day. But the culmination of that is what he called the truth-given joy. The truth-given joy. A sense of well-being, of profound existential flourishing that arises from knowing reality as it is, and the deepest reality. So concluding with Augustine, he said, the knower of that changeless light, he's now speaking of contemplative realization, which he himself had. He wasn't simply writing about other people's books, but from his own contemplative inquiry. The knower of that changeless light is the knower of truth. So when he speaks of a truth-given joy, there's no doubt what he's talking about. The knower of that changeless light is the knower of truth. The knower of it is the knower of eternity. The knower of it is love. O eternal truth, true love, beloved eternity, thou art my God. Very powerful. Very powerful. So I must say, I do not accept the generalization that Buddhism has no God. I think some Buddhists have no God. But to say that as a generalization of Buddhism, I don't accept. I don't accept. So moving on, because I will be very punctual to end at noon. I try to be very obedient. Second question here. And that was that all of that preceding was the question, a response to some rambling thoughts on if grace is at work in the individual journey, how much personal effort is really necessary? The short answer is the personal effort to overcome our vices, our harmful tendencies and behaviors and so forth, and effort given to cultivate virtue. And then with that preparation, to my mind, it's so similar to this. It's like if this were an empty vessel, or here is an empty vessel, here's a nice bowl. And I'm coming to receive something of infinite value. Infinite value, right? I'm approaching Buddha Amitabha. I'm approaching the Buddha, the Dhamma and Sangha. And I'm asking for something of infinite value in which I absolutely place my trust. I take refuge. But I'm coming with a bowl asking, please fill me. Right? That's coming for a gift. Coming for a gift. But then you ask, what's in your bowl? And if the bowl is full of cockroaches and smudge, grease, dirt, and so forth, you say, well, couldn't you have cleaned your bowl a little bit? Do you know what you're asking for? Do you know what you're asking to be poured into this bowl? Wouldn't it have been suitable, a kind of a sign of respect, perhaps, at least respect? Purify your bowl before you lift it up and ask to be filled. Right? To bring a bowl that's still dirty, kind of disrespectful. Like, don't you take this seriously? It takes some effort to fill the bowl, to purify it, to cleanse it, maybe even paint it in a very lovely fashion, to make it a chalice, make it something lovely, a show of your, an expression of your reverence for what you are to receive. But if you don't do that, then really, how much is that reverence? That's where the effort is. It's in cleaning the bowl, turning the bowl, perhaps a primitive crude vessel, into a lovely chalice, waiting to be filled. The fill, that's where the grace comes in, the blessing comes in. So this is utterly part of my worldview, and it comes from the Buddhist tradition in which I've been trained. And then we ask, Lawrence asks, at what level do or can different traditions achieve sameness? And I would suggest that the term so common in the Christian tradition of grace, hardly ever used in the Buddhist tradition, but perhaps simply by translators trying to show that Buddhism is not simply Christianity. So there's some words that Buddhist translators, that is translators from Sanskrit, Pali, Tibetan, when translating into English, will avoid just because they feel that as soon as the word is used, then one will bring in a whole bunch of Christian connotations which may or may not be appropriate to the Buddhist tradition. And so the term sin, for example, is hardly ever used. And it could be that the Sanskrit term pada or Tibetan term dikpa, I mean, sin is the perfect translation. And my wife and I, who's a Sanskritist, then I think we just call it sin. Yeah. I mean, sin is sin. If you don't like the term, then that's your problem. But this word pada, it means sin. It's something that we accumulate with actions that are really driven by delusion, craving, hostility. They are very negative, they're very unwholesome, but they can be purified. And they're purified through confession. I'm speaking as a Buddhist. Purified through confession, through remorse, but also indispensable there. Not enough just to feel sorry, remorseful, repentful, be repenting for past deeds. But in order for the sin to be purified, there must be an utter resolve to avoid such in the future. If that's not there, then it's kind of not sincere. So in Tibet, they say even the bandits were Buddhist. And they'd go off and rob people with their swords and so forth, give you know, your money, your gold. I mean, they're just bandits. There's nothing romantic about them. They were out there, but some of Tibet was very wild. And so these bandits would say they're Buddhist. And so they would come and rob people, take all their wealth and so forth, steal their horses, come back to their nomadic tents with their little altar. And then they'd offer the Buddha and said, Buddha, forgive me for being a bandit, but what can I do? It's my karma. So forgive me for what I did today, but of course I'm going to do it tomorrow again. Because that's my karma. This is Buddhism as a joke. I think there were mafiosa like that also. And I asked some friends of mine in Mexico, how many of the heads of the drug cartels are Roman Catholic? Oh, some of them. Father, forgive me that I have sinned, but of course I'm going to do it tomorrow, so wink, wink, I'll say this again tomorrow. You know? So that's where religion becomes something of a joke. The only one who's not fooled is God. So grace and blessings, I think, are essentially the same. But then, if we start taking on some of the more challenging issues, where do the blessings come from? That there is blessing is a straight translation from Tibetan. Jinlap means blessing. You can call it grace. And very often, in so many of the devotional practices, many of which I engage in myself, there is a sense of an I-thou relationship. One brings to mind Buddha Amitabha, or the Buddha Shakyamuni himself, or one of the more archetypal manifestations, like Tara. Tara, female. A feminine manifestation of enlightened consciousness, but a personification of unconditional compassion. Okay? And so, therefore, many, many Buddhists, and including myself, when I bring Tara to mind, in fact, to be very candid, when I just sat here quietly, when I was sitting in the room here, I was praying to Tara, that whatever I share this morning, may it be of benefit. It's all that really matters. May there be some benefit, and I hop on an airplane and I fly someplace else. But if there's some benefit this morning, if there's some meaning, then good. So I was praying for blessings. That's what I was doing. And for me, to focus on the divine and feminine aspect, very, very meaningful to me, just personally, and especially focusing on the divine in compassionate aspect. The divine mother means very much to me. And so blessings. And actually, I often feel blessings. I know it could be placebo effect. I know it could be imagination, but I think not. But I experience blessings coming in. Sometimes when I teach, I feel, I think there was some blessing there. And then we can ask, okay, where did it come from? Did it come from someone who is radically other? Radically other. Tara, manifestation of enlightened compassion, unconditional, timeless. But somebody radically other? Is it coming really from some outside source for which I'm beseeching from afar? Tara, wherever you are, please tune into my frequency. This is Alan calling. And then hoping that, you know, the blessings get, you know, if they travel at the speed of light, you know, she's close enough, it gets me before the lecture starts. No, not in the Buddhist tradition. So although there is devotion for those who are fine scholars, who've studied in depth and practice in depth, in the final analysis, in the Buddhist understanding, the blessings are not coming radically, existentially from the ground. They are not coming from someone other. They're not coming from something radically outside. And there's no notion that Tara or Amitabha and so forth is the creator of this individual here. So again, there are differences here. But it does raise the issue, what is the demarcation? Where do we draw the border? As Augustine is going from purgation to recollection to introversion and then finally contemplation. And my understanding is when you come to the culmination of the path, you have an unmediated encounter with, I'm choosing my words very carefully, and I hope they're correct, I'm doing my best. But when you come to the culmination of the contemplative path, according to Augustine, you have an unmediated face-to-face encounter with the changeless light. God beyond all iconography, beyond images, beyond concepts, but as a face-to-face encounter. It's not an experience of total non-duality, but an intimate and unmediated encounter. But some sense of still, this is the creator, I am the creature, I'm the createe, and that which was created. But it's an interesting question, and I think most interesting if it becomes experiential. What are the contours of our own sense of identity? Where does any one of us here, where do I start and where do I end? Just like the bowl, we know exactly where the bowl ends. It's pretty obvious, that is, in terms of the density of its mass. We know it's right there. Right here, there may be a tiny electromagnetic field generated by it, but in terms of density, the contours of the bowl are very clear. The contours of the body are very, very clear. Nothing mysterious about that. The body breathes, it's giving off moisture and so forth, but overall, contours of the body, demarcations of my body and your body, no problem, quite clear, right? But now when it comes to my awareness and my sense of identity, this person, I do have a body, I'm not the same as my body. I do have a mind. In Buddhism, we say you're not equivalent to the mind. I refine my mind. I try to purify my mind. I try to develop, focus my mind, develop greater presence of mind. So there's someone doing that, and it's me, a person. So in terms of the mind itself, but now really focusing in on personal identity, where do I start and where do I end? And who am I? So I think this may turn into one of the fruitful, interesting, and certainly open-ended conversations with Father Lawrence and myself. Buddhist understanding is that we impute, we designate a sense of self onto that which is not I. This body is not a person. It's a lot of tissue, a ton of tissue, a lot of cells, bone cells, brain cells, heart, internal organs, skin and hair and so forth. No part of the body is a person, no collection of assembly of these organic parts, organs and so forth, constitute a person. Like this one here called Alan Wallace. The body's not a person, nor is my mind, with this whole array of functions of memory, imagination, attention, dreams, and so forth and so on. The mind is not a person. Not a person. But on the basis of that, if somebody should ask me, Alan, who are you? Who are you? Well, then I might describe, well, I'm a man, I have a male body, and I have a mind, and I'm 62 years old, and I was born here, lived there, and so forth and so on. And so my very sense of identity can be based on personal narrative. And the kind of the focal point there is, well, where am I physically embodied? Well, I'm over here, I'm not over there. So on the basis of that, it's very easy to, and I think we generally do, adopt a sense of personal identity that is very much confined within this lifetime. How old are you? I'm 62 years old, born in California. Before then, I wasn't. Alan wasn't. Alan Wallace wasn't. Alan Wallace, this individual here, I wasn't anywhere 64 years ago. You look for me all over the planet or any other planet, you won't find Alan Wallace, this guy here, this man, didn't exist anywhere at all. And if I imagine I live a nice fortunate life and live another 30 years, well, 35 years from now, this person, Alan Wallace, the American guy born in California, will not exist anywhere. Because this Alan Wallace, this identity is arising independent upon this body and this mind. In other words, they're bookends for that localized, finite sense of who I am. I'm this person who is born and I shall die. I wasn't before and I won't be after. So that's one sense of identity. It has a certain validity to it, but makes sense, right? If I committed a crime and somebody gave me a life sentence, okay, that would be for the duration of my life. But then I'm free when my life is over, right? But Buddhist understanding is that all there is to personal identity. Does that tell the whole story? Buddha's understanding is no, that's not it. That's the chapter. Some people's chapter is very short. People die in childhood, in infancy, adolescence, and so forth. Longer chapters, short chapters, but again, whatever it is, it's a chapter. But the continuum of consciousness, out of which this particular human mind arising independent upon this body arose, the condition of consciousness that came to this life, that's pre-Alan, but that continuum of consciousness was formed, conditioned, configured into the mind that I personally have, independent upon my body, the brain, the environment, my upbringing, and so forth. And when I die, this particular configuration of my mind, again, I'm being a man, man's body, personal history, American, speaking English and German and Tibetan, but not French or Italian, that one will dissolve. But dissolves not into obliteration, doesn't simply dissolve into the Godhead or primordial consciousness or Buddhahood or anything like that, dissolves back into this ground state, one's individuated stream of consciousness. And so in Buddhism, now I'm just speaking Buddhism, where there's a difference, clearly, and I think Lawrence and I are totally comfortable with this, our differences, of course, is that in Buddhism it then makes sense to say, in a past life I was such and such. I might have been a woman, I might have been a Tibetan, I might have been another species for that matter. And in some future life, well, I'd love to be born in Sukhavati. Perhaps I will be a human being in some life, but then who will that be? I don't know. But the continuum of consciousness that carries on, that's the common thread. So in this sense, I am now relates not only to the chapter with its bookends of conception and death, but something before and after. And so then in this Buddhist context, we speak of an evolution, a transformation, when it is deliberate, when we are devoted to a spiritual path. Then we're not simply bouncing around like a ball in a pinball machine, boing, 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 here, going here and there and there, life after life, but there's actually a continuity in evolution, a path of spiritual maturation, or to use the term used earlier, a path of spiritual growth. Because one life is just too short for almost all of us to come to the culmination of the path. And so there's a deeper sense of identity. Is from this short lifetime, I'll evolve, develop as much as I can, but I don't know whether I'll die tonight or in 30 years. How? Who knows? That's okay. Either way, it's okay. But then one can ask, is there anything beyond that? So there you are, an evolving soul, so to speak, striving, and if you continue striving, then continue to mature, to follow a path of unfolding, of liberation, spiritual maturation. But is there anything beyond that? In the Buddhist tradition, especially this whole Mahayana tradition, the answer is yes. That there is the deepest dimension, sometimes called Buddha nature, pristine awareness, primordial consciousness. And this, to use the term, I actually use this as a translator from Tibetan, I use the term from Meister Eckhart, the medieval German term that he used when he spoke about the experiential access to the God beyond the Trinity, the Godhead, the ultimate ground of being. The term that he used was auf Deutsch, Durchbruch, the breakthrough of individuation to something that is utterly transcendent. And that's so close to a term in Tibetan called Tekchur, that I've simply adopted Meister Eckhart's term from medieval German, and I call it the breakthrough, where you break through this crystallized continuum of your own being, your own consciousness, one could say your own soul. You break through that. It has its own reality, but it's not the ground reality. It's not the ultimate ground of being. You break through that, not in the sense of destroying it, but seeing through it, breaking through it to an infinite ground that is beyond individuation. It's neither mine nor yours, nor is it both, nor is it neither. It's totally beyond all conceptual constructs, even the constructs of existence and non-existence. This is utterly, utterly ontologically transcendent. In no way can be captured by even the most brilliant conceptual mind, a dimension of being that is beyond space, beyond time, beyond individuation, and it is the very divine ground of being. And to know oneself, ultimately, is to know oneself to be that. So there's a Buddhist view. In terms of knowledge and faith, I sense, again, there are Christians who say, well, it really has nothing to do with knowledge, it's all about faith and belief. Faith, gressing, therein lies your salvation. But of course, let alone the Gnostics, even in the mainstream Roman Catholic tradition, the role of knowing God, as we see from Augustine himself, the passion to know God. I've certainly seen this in the Desert Fathers and early Christianity, that meditation is also about knowing, making discoveries, contemplative through contemplative inquiry. But for to my sense, having taught meditation for about, 36 years, is what I found is that I have a number of students, about 30 scattered all over the world right now, who are just dedicating themselves to full-time meditative practice for 8, 10 hours a day for months or even years on end. Some have now been practicing for 5 years. And what I have found, that for all of them without exception, who have the that who are willing to make that degree of sacrifice, because they're just now living in utter simplicity and doing nothing other, their lives are just about this. There's nothing else going on. They're hardly even on internet, an occasional email to me and hardly anything else. That is, without distraction, focusing single-pointedly there, none of them have that degree of dedication without having a belief system that makes that sensible. Right. And therefore, all of them have faith. They're not coming in from simply some secular perspective of sheer agnosticism. Well, who knows? My sense is they'll never get that degree of crystallization, of focus, with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your soul, absolutely focusing on the spiritual life, on the cultivation of the heart and mind, without having faith. And so in this regard, faith is an absolutely necessary precursor to knowledge. And frankly, I don't think that's unique to the contemplative life. If we think, I've been trained in science somewhat, but imagine getting a PhD in neuroscience. That means 4 years of undergraduate, maybe 6 years of doctoral work, a couple of years of postdoc, and now you can call yourself a neuroscientist. If you didn't have faith from the beginning that this was really a worthwhile field of endeavor, that you can make significant discoveries, you can really learn things that are meaningful and of value, and if you didn't take on faith the many discoveries that have already been made, if you didn't trust your mentors, if you didn't trust the people who are making the technology, the MRIs and the EEG and so forth, if you didn't have a field of faith and trust in the whole tradition, then why on earth would you devote 12 or 15 years to getting an education in it? There's no way. And so I think whether it's science, whether it's art or music, people will not give the time, will not make the sacrifices unless they have faith. It's not just religious. So the notion of being without belief is preposterous. Everybody's got belief. Whether you're Richard Dawkins, he believes all kinds of stuff, things that he doesn't know. He's a man of faith. He just places his faith elsewhere. We're all people. We're all betting our lives on something. And that's where our choice is. We're betting our lives on something we don't know. Unless you're already a Buddha, unless you're already realized, unless you've already realized perfection, we're all betting our lives on something we don't know. So what are you going to bet your life on? That's, I think, the real question. So if we secularize the terminology, what's your working hypothesis? Because we're all betting our lives on something. The agnostic, the atheist, the materialist, the fundamentalist Christian, the orthodox Buddhist, and so forth, we're all betting our lives on something. So bet well. Bet well. And faith, if we want to know, because I would really love to push back the field of metaphysics, I'd love to push back the area that we can only have faith in. I'd love to know more and more and more as much as possible. Faith is like picking up the fragrance, and knowledge is like sitting down for the meal. But if you don't pick up the fragrance, why would you ever go for the meal? It might take some sacrifice. So in this regard, I'd like to quote two great individuals, highly respected within their own tradition, so they're not just favorites of mine, that I found very meaningful. They're a bit lengthy quotes, but I think with my 7 minutes, this may be a good time to spend. St. Gregory Palamas, 1296 to 1359, one of the great Greek Orthodox contemplatives. Here's his statement. I'll read it slowly, like a fine wine. I don't want to gulp it down. Through grace, God in his entirety penetrates the saints in their entirety. And the saints in their entirety penetrate God entirely, exchanging the whole of him for themselves and acquiring him alone as the reward of their ascent towards him. For he embraces them as the soul embraces the body, enabling them to be in him as his own members. The intellect, because of its freedom from worldly cares, is able to act with its full vigor and become capable of perceiving the ineffable goodness of God. Now that's knowledge. Of perceiving the ineffable goodness of God. So faith is to come to that perception. That is one of total infusion, as we see. That fills me with faith. Then a person you've very unlikely heard of, unless you've heard lectures of mine in the past, 19th century contemplative, living out in the wildness of eastern Tibet, way up in the nomadic country, living from 1835 to 1904. And by the way, the dates are completely irrelevant. It just doesn't matter whether that was 14th century from St. Gregory Palamas or this is 12th century. It strikes me as being completely timeless. That's my sense. Here's from Dujom Lingba, great Tibetan contemplative. He says, now this, of course, is going to be Buddhist terminology. Once you have recognized all phenomena within samsara and nirvana as the play of your own appearances alone, you will actualize the great all-pervasive realm of pristine space, which is self-originating, spontaneous, primordial consciousness. Due to the unceasing power in the nature of primordial consciousness, there is total knowledge and total awareness of all phenomena, without its ever merging with or entering into objects. Primordial consciousness is self-originating, naturally clear, free of outer and inner obscuration. It is the all-pervasive, radiant, clear infinity of space, free of contamination. So he's speaking of a knowing here, a direct perception. So I've already responded briefly to the question Lawrence pays. I see you have 5 minutes. The question being, is it the concept of the person at the core of the two traditions that really makes the difference? It may very well be. There may be some significant difference there. And that is, at what point do we say no longer I, but thee? Thereon hangs the tale. Or there is the response to the question, ultimately, where are the blessings coming from? What is the origin of grace? Within you or without you? And where's the demarcation? So a little bit of response to that already. Here's one, a bit provocative. I like provocation. If Buddhism lacks the warm human touch, which it indubitably does on occasion for some Buddhists, I've seen it, no question. Does Christianity treat God as an emotional projection? I suspect that's true for some Christians on certain occasions. So how about this, lacking warm human touch, and then just going ushy-gushy into emotions and saccharine sanctimoniousness? Very different from sanctity. A Buddhist response very briefly here. From the Buddha, wisdom without compassion is bondage. Compassion without wisdom is bondage. So it is certainly true that one may follow a Buddhist path and then find it becoming dry, austere, barren, indifferent, dispassionate, but in a dry and arid way, in which case, frankly, you've fallen off into a detour. That's not the Buddhist path. But people mistake that. Think about it. After all, I have no desires. Oh, the Buddhist ideal is not to have no desires. That's brain dead. It's crazy. I see so many stupid aphorisms. Life is suffering. The Buddha never said that. The ideal of Buddhism has no desires. Oh, yeah, really? That's ridiculous. No desires. You'll never feel hungry again. You never want to achieve a liberation. You never want to meditate, because that's desire. And then, of course, if you now have this ideal, I must be without desire, how are you going to achieve that? By desiring it. That's a catch-22 if there ever was one. It's absurd. No, it's absurd. It's ridiculous. It comes from bad translation. Life is suffering. Bad translation. The ideal of Buddhist practice, no desires. Bad translation. That can really be very misleading. So I wanted to end on this note, now that I see about three minutes. Coming back to someone who is neither Christian nor Buddhist, but in terms of being an intellectual hero, he's one of my intellectual heroes, and that's William James, one of the least dogmatic or the formidable minds of Eurocentric culture, European-American culture, great pioneer of modern psychology, profound philosopher, and wrote truly one of the great classics of religious experience, varieties of religious experience. He's a very passionate man, in a very good sense of the term. I think deeply troubled by the rising domination of materialism. Very sympathetic to spirit, to religion, especially to its contemplative core, and I will use that term. But it was a call to anyone who is listening, a a call to revitalize for religion in the modern world to be reborn deliberately, consciously, to come back to its experiential roots, because there are so many things doctrinally and institutionally that divide us. And then as soon as we start reifying that and feeling, oh, I have the Buddha, I am Buddhist, I have the only way, we're the only ones following the path to enlightenment, Christian, the Muslim, the Hindu, the atheist can be as dogmatic and fundamentalist as anyone else we know, and quite militant. But William James said, let us come back to experience. And here's what he said. Let empiricism once become associated with religion, as hitherto, through some strange misunderstanding, it has become associated with irreligion. So often it's the scientists, the materialists, that are holding up the banner, we're the true empiricists, you religious people, you're just believers, we're non-believers. Claptrap, mumbo jumbo, what rubbish to say that the atheists have no beliefs. Give me a break. Earthworms have no belief. Cockroaches have no beliefs. Atheists have as many beliefs as the most fundamentalist Christian or Buddhist. They just believe different things. It's totally absurd. I never use the word believer and non-believer, unless you're talking about earthworms versus human beings. But if you're an intelligent person, you give me a break, you know. But so there it is. There's this ridiculous demarcation. Is the believers on one side. We're the woolly-headed people who believe things that we can never demonstrate, whereas the scientists just give me the facts and nothing but the facts. Completely false, ridiculous dichotomy. Never been true in the history of science. So they're living in a mythology of their own discipline and a mythology of religion in this way. That's why I have so little interest to read such people. It's such silliness. So there it is. But he's saying, by some strange misunderstanding, empiricism has been divorced from religion. He said, if we should do this, come back to the vital core of experience. Bring this into religion. He said, if we do so, I believe that a new era of religion as well as philosophy will be ready to begin. I fully believe that such an empiricism is a more natural ally than dialectics ever were or can be of the religious life. He speaks of a science of religion, last quote and I'm finished. He speaks of a science of religion saying this can offer mediation between different believers and help to bring about consensus of opinion. And it might command public adherence comparable to that presently granted to the physical sciences. Quote, even the personally non-religious might accept its conclusions on trust, much as blind persons now accept the fact of optics. It might appear as foolish to refuse them. So it's in that spirit, as Dharma brothers, as fellow contemplatives, that I'm really delighted to be with you here with my Dharma brother, Lawrence Friedman, to come back to experience. And while acknowledging and respecting the differences, and we're not trying to smudge those away, coming back to experience and saying, my goodness, what a wealth of common ground. And if we can make discoveries, are making, have made, do made, and continue to make discoverings through the most in-depth contemplative inquiry that are replicated by Greek Orthodox and the Roman Catholics and the Theravada Buddhists and the Mahayana Buddhists and perhaps the Taoists and the Sufis for that matter, if we find that we're making discoveries that are the same discoveries coming in from different vantage points, then these are discoveries every bit as much as discoveries made in modern science. And as most people take scientific discoveries as a matter of faith, based upon the authority of great institutions like Oxford, Cambridge, Harvard, and so forth. So what he's saying is there could be a science of religion where people, contemplatives especially, coming together, sharing their insights and seeing where's the common ground. These are discoveries. These are discoveries about the nature of consciousness, the human soul, the potentials of the human mind, and perhaps even the very ground, the divine ground of being itself. So I think there's enormous potential here. And in today's world, where we are beset with so many challenges, so deep, I think it should be obvious to everyone who's paying attention, the solutions will not be found simply by furthering science and technology. Will not be found just by looking outwards. The data are in, it won't happen. So either we doom ourselves, or we start looking within to discover our own internal natural resources to balance out this radical disparity that characterizes the modern world. Thank you very much.
You can hear more talks and conversations in the media section on our website, wccm.org, or in your favorite podcast player. Thanks for listening. For WCCM, I am Elba Rodriguez.